Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last week, WFAE hosted a special evening with former Nightline host Ted Koppel at the Charlotte Convention Center. During the event, Koppel sat down with former Nightline colleague and NPR Weekend All Things Considered host Michelle Martin. They talked about Koppel's early life and his decision to become a journalist, some of the important historical events he covered throughout his long career, and his thoughts on the importance of journalism to our democracy. Today on Charlotte Talks, we listen back to a portion of that conversation.
Well, actually, now that I think about it, it's probably safer that you give me a standing O before you hear what I have to say.
It's good to see you. This may come as a surprise to some who think that people who earn their livings in front of a camera would love nothing more than to talk about themselves all day. But the reality of it is you do not very much like talking about yourself. I know this, but I would hope that you would indulge us for just a few minutes because yours is one of the great American stories. And I just happen to know, just from being here all day, that there are those who would love you to tell a little bit about how you came to the United States to begin with. Your parents were born in Germany. You went to England, I believe, as a refugee, as a very young child, as a baby.
No. I was born in England. My parents were German Jews who had to leave Germany, who found refuge in England. And it's really, in one sense, it's very appropriate to be talking about it on this day, June 6th, 75th anniversary of D-Day. And if you'll forgive me, I just want to make this one observation. It was England that gave my parents and me, I was born there, was a tiny child growing up during the war, it was England that gave us refuge. But we immigrated to this country in 1953. And it was America that gave us a home. The point I want to make is that, you know, look around you. We are a tapestry of people. We don't look alike. We don't come from the same places. Some of us came here voluntarily. Your forefathers did not. They were dragged here against their will. And yet somehow this great country has been welded together by this extraordinary mixture of human beings. I never would have had the opportunities that I've had in this country. In England. Great Britain is a great place. Love it. I'm grateful to it, as I say, for providing sanctuary to my parents. But it is to this day still a place where who your family was, where you went to school, what your background is, determines in some large measure how far you're going to be able to progress. That was not the case for me here. No restrictions. So, you know, this is an important day for me. I remember my father listening to the radio, waiting for any scrap of news about how the Allied forces were doing in the invasion. Important times, and this is a great day.
Well, thank you for reminding us of that. Why journalism?
Never wanted to do anything else. I mean, going back to growing up as a child in England, in London, I remember my father listening to the BBC, and there was this American journalist by the name of Edward R. Murrow, who was broadcast back to CBS in this country, were considered so inspiring on one level that the BBC rebroadcast some of Murrow's broadcasts in England. And I suspect, looking back now, that memory is playing tricks on me. But I think, even at the age of 4 and 5, something rubbed off. And I can't remember a time in my life when I didn't want to do what Ed Murrow was doing. That just struck me as, and you know, we often at Nightline, we used to have young people come in, and when the interns came and they'd say, why journalism? Why do you want to be a journalist? And I'd say, just think about what we do. We would get up every morning and we'd get on the phone and we'd have a conversation. And the nature of that conversation would be, what's the most interesting thing going on in the world today? Who are the most interesting people that we can talk to? Sometimes, where are the most interesting places that we can go? And we got to do that stuff on somebody else's dime. And they paid us for it, right?
Well, you especially, what? But now. Did your parents think it was a good choice? I mean, a lot of times when people have struggled as your parents had struggled, people think of journalism as being kind of grubby and disreputable. Did they think it was a good choice for you?
You know, they were so, my parents, by the time we came here, let's see, in 1953, my father would have been almost 60. My mother was 55. Back then, that was a lot older than it is today. They were already old people. And it was difficult for them. You know, I don't think they ever totally adjusted to living in the United States, but they made that sacrifice for me because they thought, correctly as it turned out, that this was still the land of opportunity. So, you know, I sometimes wonder, because I went through the elementary British school system, I was very young when I graduated high school. I graduated, I just turned 16. I had no idea, really, where I would go to college. My parents had not a clue. I mean, they didn't know one from another. So this notion of what I wanted to do, I think their attitude was, you know, you're in this strange place. We can't figure it out, but,
you know. You'll be okay.
We brought you here, and I think it'll be all right.
I know that people ask you this all the time, and it's slightly annoying, but the reality of it is there are stories that stick with you. That, you know, even now, maybe you can smell it. You can smell what it was like. You can feel what it was like to be there. Give us two. Are there two stories that just stick with you all these years that that are meaningful to you?
Yes, and look, Vietnam was meaningful. Over the course of two tours in Southeast Asia, Grace Anne, my wife, and our children lived in Hong Kong. I was down in Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, all in all, for a period of about 3.5 years. I was very young at the time. And the demands of, as you know, of American networks, we want action, we want stuff involving the Americans. As I look back on all those years there, I look back on it as a missed opportunity to really tell the American public something about Vietnam. I took an intensive total immersion course at Berlitz in Vietnamese before I went. And, you know, for a few weeks I was the pride of what in those days they still called the room boys at the Caravelle Hotel. These were the middle-aged and elderly men who made the beds and took care of them. I was the first American they'd ever met who spoke any Vietnamese at all. And they would put me through my paces. How old are you? Are you married? Yes, I am married. Do you have children? Yes, I have. How many children do you have? And it was just an object of such curiosity. And then I was sent off to go cover the Marines up in I Corps. And for months thereafter, I never spoke Vietnamese again, right? And didn't really cover Vietnam.
That's Ted Koppel, former longtime host of Nightline, talking to NPR Weekend All Things Considered host Michelle Martin last week at WFAE's annual event. We have more of that conversation in a few moments. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Today we're listening back to a conversation between former Nightline host Ted Koppel and NPR's Michelle Martin at a special event for WFAE last week. In their conversation, they talked about some of the many historical moments Koppel covered in his long career, and he also commented on the privilege that journalists have talking to people who have done extraordinary things.
You and I haven't done that much, but we get to talk to people who have. Sometimes what they've done is terrible, evil, nasty. Sometimes what they've done is mind-bogglingly great and wonderful. But to have lived a life in which I have variously met Nelson Mandela 2 days after he came out of prison, sat in the backyard of Winnie Mandela's home to talk to him at great length, to be sitting across the desk from Mikhail Gorbachev in the Kremlin on the last day of the Soviet Union, watching with him as the Soviet flag came down for the last time and the Russian flag was raised, sitting on the other side of his desk as he said goodbye to George Bush and as they passed the nuclear football off to Boris Yeltsin. You know, who gets to do things like that? Journalists do. We get to be witnesses to history, and we get to be those who convey these stories to the American public. And if I may, let me sort of redirect our conversation a little bit as to why what is happening today is so worrisome. A democracy cannot survive if we do not have credible sources of information. You can't do it. And what has changed in our careers, in the years that you and I have been working at this profession, what has changed is the fact that you now have the capacity, by virtue of the internet, of anyone with a cell phone or a laptop computer being able to convey information. Now, we wouldn't dream of going to a doctor who didn't have a medical degree. We wouldn't dream of hiring a lawyer who didn't have a law degree. We wouldn't dream of hiring a plumber who hadn't learned how to be a plumber, who hadn't done his apprenticeship. But somehow we seem to believe in this day and age that it's all right for anybody to be a journalist. And yes, the First Amendment does grant us that privilege. You have to have a license to drive, you have to have a license to go fishing, you don't have to have a license to be a journalist. But you do have to be a professional. You need that. The nation needs that. We cannot allow ourselves to be led by the nose by thousands or tens of thousands of people who just think it's fun to put crap out there on a daily basis.
So, So who do you hold responsible for this state of affairs? Is it the technology itself? Is it that the media on the whole, because there are so many entities now that consider themselves media, is it political actors with an agenda who have a vested interest in promulgating that point of view? Who do you hold responsible for that state of affairs? And then we are going to turn it around to if you have thoughts about what would be fix it. So, but I do want to ask you first, who do you hold responsible for the state of affairs we find ourselves in?
Look, it was the case before Trump. It'll be the case after Trump. It is pointless to hold him uniquely responsible. The technology is certainly a big part of it, but we have to be honest enough to look at our own profession, Michelle, and to recognize that certainly when I was a young correspondent, we covered the world at ABC, and our colleagues at NBC and CBS did the same thing. We had correspondents all over the world, foreign correspondents, but it's expensive to have men and women overseas. It's expensive to move their families over there. You know what's cheap? Putting half a dozen people around a table in front of several television cameras and having them yell at each other. That's cheap. It is not accidental, and it is not great journalism that so much of the coverage these days is focused obsessively on Donald Trump. He is not the most important thing that is going on in the world right now.
Okay.
But, one more thought, but you're watching. You're listening. You're reading about it in the New York Times, in the Washington Post, in the local papers here, in USA Today. And the fact of the matter is, if it weren't good for business, our colleagues would not be doing it. Not to the degree that they're doing it right now.
But you wrote about this. I mean, you wrote about this in the Post in January. You said, the dirty little secret about the United States' relationship with Trump is that we have become addicted to him. His ups, his downs, his laughs, his frowns are, as the lovely song from My Fair Lady once put it in another context altogether, second nature to us now, like breathing out and breathing in. It goes on. You say that...
Oh, keep going. That guy can...
Okay. That guy can really write. All right, I'll skip to the end here. I'll edit. A new president may provide a sense of relief and normalcy, but he or she will not satisfy our craving for outrage. Trump's detractors are outraged by him. His supporters are outraged with him. He is a national Rorschach test. Love him or hate him, you can't ignore him. One way or another, Trump will be renewed for another season. Okay, that's going to be not a very pleasant thought for some, but look, we're going back to, he has the nuclear codes.
Yeah.
I mean, he has the nuclear code.
Oh, yeah.
So what are we supposed to do?
Look.
He has the nuclear codes. He has kids sleeping on the floor, surrounded by cages, covered in blankets. He's about to put tariffs on Mexico and raise the price of, you know, everything if he can. He's already put tariffs on our major trading partners. So what are we supposed to do?
You get a chance to vote again in 18 months.
Well, okay, yes.
I mean, look.
But I mean, in terms of the media and that which we have control over, are we supposed to what? Ignore him? I mean,
no, on the contrary, and surely we don't ignore him. All I'm saying is that what belongs on the front page of the New York Times and the Washington Post is objective, hard news. You've got an editorial page, you've got an opinion page, you've got room for all kinds of columns to express a wide variety of opinion on what's being done. But you want to talk about disastrous moves by presidents? Do you know how much the United States spent on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? somewhere in the neighborhood of $3 trillion. Now, let me just take a moment to explain to you what $1 trillion is. I know we have some bankers here, but it's still, you know, it's still worth explaining. I want you to imagine a business that was created in the year that Christ was born. And that business proceeds to lose $1 million on its first day in operation. And then it loses another million on day two, day three, day four, day five. And the people who run this business are incredibly hardworking, but dumb as a post. And they proceed to lose $1 million a day, generation after generation, 365 days a year. It'll be another 1,000 years from tonight. Another 1,000 years before that family will have lost $1 trillion. Now, you want to consider for a moment the impact of what the Bush administration taking us to war in Iraq, the consequences and the impact of that on the American economy, on housing, on childcare, on education, across the board. Imagine if we had that $3 trillion to spend on our infrastructure. Wow. We can't even get $1 trillion for it, in part because we wasted it in Iraq. All I'm saying, Michelle, is I understand Donald Trump is a unique phenomenon, and he drives some people nuts. But he's not the first American president to do outrageous things, or to do things that have been incredibly damaging to the United States of America. So, you know, I'm assuming that we will somehow muddle through for the next 18 months, and if enough people in this country agree that Donald Trump has not been a good president, or in fact has been a disastrous president, they'll elect somebody else. What I worry about is that our divisions in this country today, exacerbated by the internet.
And the Russians.
And the Russians. And the, look, as you know, I wrote a book about cyber warfare. I consider the internet to be one of the great gifts of our time. I also know that it is a weapon of mass destruction. And if you have been worried about the North Koreans bombing us with a nuclear weapon, don't. They won't. It would be suicidal for them to do it. But will they attack us with cyber weapons? You bet. They already have. They already are. What do you think the Iranians are going to do? They're very good at this. The Russians are even better, as are the Chinese. We are the most vulnerable country in the world to cyber attack. You know what we've done to prepare for the eventuality of a cyber attack in this country? Zip. Nothing. So, you know, I think we've got bigger things to worry about than Donald Trump.
The tweet of the day.
That's Ted Koppel, well known for his many years as the host of Nightline, interviewed by NPR Weekend All Things Considered host Michelle Martin, recorded in Charlotte last week at a special event for WFAE. We have more in a moment. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and today we're listening back to a special conversation WFAE hosted last week with Ted Koppel and NPR's Michelle Martin. Here's the conclusion of that conversation.
We've got about 10 minutes left, so I want to be sure we really use that time. I was going to ask you earlier whether you ever considered leaving journalism to become an activist. But you are kind of an activist along with your partner in life, who's actually taken the lead on this. Tell us a little bit more about one of your priorities from this stage of your life, led, of course, by your better half.
Yeah. My wife and I have been married 56 years. Tribute to her, not to me.
We know.
She has something called COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. I won't spend a lot of time on it, but I suspect that most of you really don't know very much about it. And what she and I are trying to do is raise public awareness, because there are an estimated 30 million people in this country who have COPD. 16 million have been diagnosed. The other 10 to 15 million have not been diagnosed. More people die in this country of COPD every year than died, I'm talking about Americans, who died in Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan combined. 150,000 Americans a year. It is the third major chronic disease when it comes to fatalities in this country. You know where it ranks in terms of funding at the National Institutes of Health? About 165th. So, yes, I have become, with Grace Anne, an activist in trying to make people aware of this and see if we can't change things.
Why don't we know this? It's just, you know what I mean? I think we all feel ourselves to be well-educated people. We're kind of aware. We listen to NPR. Why don't we know this? It just makes me crazy.
Look, every disease needs a champion. Mm-hmm. It's a terrible thing to say. I mean, there are so many diseases out there. So many problems out there. And if you happen to be someone who is suffering from cancer, or if you happen to be someone who is suffering from diabetes, or if you happen to be someone who is suffering from heart disease, that's the most important disease in the country. And look, you take something like AIDS, which really had an uphill climb in terms of getting any kind of acknowledgement from the American public, from the medical community, but because a lot of gay people are actors and show business people and folks who know how to mobilize public attention and public awareness, they did a brilliant job of making sure that the American public could not ignore the AIDS crisis. And just to give you a sense, COPD, which kills 150,000 people a year, has an annual budget at NIH of about $100 million. AIDS, which, you know, I don't want to get into a competition among diseases, but AIDS, which kills many fewer people, has a $2 billion budget. Why? We're a country that requires to be motivated. We need to be awakened.
Is it in part because COPD is so isolating?
Yes.
You want to withdraw as opposed to, is that part of it?
The problem with COPD is that it makes breathing difficult. So people with COPD tend, as Michelle is suggesting, tend to become more isolated. They tend to withdraw. And the medical community, our family doctors, have not been terrific about early diagnosis. That's one of the things we're trying to change. You know, you go for a health exam, and they'll give you a blood test and a urine test and an EKG and maybe a chest x-ray, depending on what your symptoms are. But they do not give you a spirometry test, which is actually a very simple test, and could identify people with COPD much earlier on, in their 40s and 50s. rather than when they've already lost more than 50% of their lung capacity. And just to give you a sense of what it's like to have serious COPD, try pinching your nose and breathing through a straw for a minute or two, and you'll have a sense of what it's like.
Well, thank you for your work in this area, and I think a lot of us feel a great debt to you for inspiring us through your work, your hard work, your honesty, as a colleague, as a generous colleague, as a generous friend, as an example. So you've given us hope, but I'd like to ask you what's giving you hope. Think of something.
Can I leave people with a laugh instead of...
No, okay, you can do
yeah,
it. Okay. We should have worked this out ahead of time. No, you can't leave people with a after you answer my question.
What gives me hope?
Yeah, what's giving you hope? What are you encouraged by?
When I talk about and I realize I've spent an inordinate amount of time talking about the failings of journalism, NPR is a pretty amazing phenomenon. And NPR, I think, which used to be, it tilted a little bit too far to the left, I think it has made heroic efforts. And right back at you, Michelle, all you have to do is listen to All Things Considered on weekends and listen to my dear friend Michelle. Good, interesting, substantive material on NPR. And there ain't a whole hell of a lot of it out there anymore. So how about a big round of applause for NPR? That's great.
Having answered my question, because you are my colleague, mentor, and friend, I will give you the last word.
Thank you. So in 1972, you were asking before about major news events that I covered. 1972, I was with Richard Nixon in China. And Nixon was taken out, as almost all foreign visitors are, to the Great Wall of China. And our former ABC colleague, Tom Jarrell, was the pool reporter, which meant he was the one guy on the wall with a camera crew and a microphone, and he walks up to the president and he says, Mr. President, what do you think of the wall? And Richard Nixon said, well, one can only say. And for those of you too young to remember Nixon, that's actually a pretty damn good Nixon.
Okay.
One can only say, upon looking at this wall, that this is truly a great wall. Swear to God, that's what he said. So on the plane from Beijing to Shanghai, we were all suffering a little from sleep deprivation. It occurs to me that he had a lot of very smart people around him who could have anticipated that question and come up with a better answer. So in my fevered imagination, I had Richard Nixon singing the answer with a song that I wrote and that I'm going to sing for you.
Okay.
Right now. And it goes something like this. In fact, it goes exactly like this. It's a grand old wall. It's a long-standing wall, wins the prize for its size and its age. It gave just rewards to the Mongol hordes, drove the kulaks away in a rage. From Beijing to the seas, it has saved the Chinese till the days of the Kuomintang. From Ming to Han and on and on. With the Great Wall, you can't go wrong.
Ted Koppel.
That was Ted Koppel, recorded last week as NPR's Michelle Martin interviewed him at a special event here in Charlotte hosted by WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.